of another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Jonathan Roger, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 23rd issue of the New York Times Business Section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The first article is entitled, Sick of AI? Slop? So are tech giants. Spotify, LinkedIn, and others are trying to dig out of a digital sewage heap full of low-quality content made with artificial intelligence. By Tiffany Su, reporting from San Francisco. The worst of artificial intelligence slop has cluttered Google searches with recipes for glue-topped pizza, Amazon listings with sham biographies, and Facebook feeds with images of shrimp Jesus. The digital sewage heap has sprawled across tech platforms, cheapening meaningful content and polluting the information ecosystem as chatbots and video generators continue to advance. Now, Silicon Valley wants to take out the trash. Spotify, a music streamer, said it removed 75 million bulk uploads, duplicate songs, and other spammy tracks last year, a sizable chunk of its total portfolio. LinkedIn said in July that, quote, AI slop is a top priority for all of us, end quote, and developed a button for users to report it. Researchers from YouTube's parent company, Google, described how a video service wiped 130,000 channels of low-quality content off its platform over 6 months. Across the internet, tech companies are undertaking a generative waste detox, overwhelmed in many cases by the same slop first made possible by their own AI tools. Mobile messaging apps, restaurant review sites, scholarly archives, and dating services are all rooting out or downplaying junk generated by AI, many relying on the same technology to pull off the purge. People are tiring of AI's effect on the environment and its pressure on jobs and mental health. AI slop is just another, quote, festering wound, end quote, said Aiden Walker, a content creator and researcher studying online trends for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a global affairs think tank. Users have gradually gotten more and more upset about it, he said. The climate of opinion has now recognizably shifted, so these companies are finally confronting these problems. Generative AI can produce increasingly realistic images, audios, and videos, but only some of it qualifies as slop. Tech companies are largely targeting the kind of low-grade clickbait that is easy to make, spread, consume, and forget. The fast fashion edging out couture, the pink slime subsuming the steak. Unchecked, the synthetic swamp online could, quote, crowd out human creativity, corrode cultural value, and destabilize public discourse, end quote, European researchers wrote last year. Slop has become so prevalent that Merriam-Webster, the dictionary publisher, chose it as its word of the year in 2025. Deezer, a French streaming service, said this spring that nearly half of the tracks updated to its system each day were artificially generated, many of them never heard by users. AI generates more than a third of what is uploaded to Apple Music. Adam Mosseri, the head of Instagram, said late last year that it would soon, quote, be more practical, end quote, to trace real media than fake media. His observation came not long after Meta, Instagram's parent company, rolled out an all-AI video stream derided by many as a showcase for slop. Many tech companies now trying to manage AI slop are also the ones enabling it. In July, Meta promised to support a European pact to make AI-generated content more identifiable via detection, labeling, and tagging. That same month, the company also released an image generator that automatically opted in public Instagram accounts as a reference for the tool. Meta removed the feature after 3 days of backlash. AI slop is a double-edged sword in that a lot of these platforms experienced upticks in engagement as a result of it, said Paul Shovlin, an expert in AI at Ohio University. But then it got to a point where it became a liability because there's so much flotsam and jetsam that it's now hard for users to find the kind of quality that they're looking for. Google, for example, has gone all in on AI, linking its Gemini model to its email, maps, and travel services and search. More than 20% of the initial short videos on YouTube served to new users are AI-generated slop, according to an experiment conducted last year by Capwing, an online video editor that is powered by AI. One of the most popular YouTube slop channels, Capwing estimated, earned $4.25 million annually. It has since been suspended from a YouTube monetization program. Neil Mohan, YouTube's chief executive, wrote in a blog post that, quote, managing AI slop, end quote, was a top priority this year. Recently, researchers at Google considered the challenge. Rather than evaluate videos individually, they looked at upload pace, repetitive templates, and other patterns that could signal coordinated abusive behavior. They found 50,000 clusters of accounts which were removed. Some digital media experts, however, worried that the approach could overreach and also penalize legitimate content creators who publish large volumes of content. While academic research helps advance industry understanding, it doesn't reflect the many layers of defense we use to enforce our policies, YouTube said in a statement. This includes robust safeguards to ensure well-intentioned creators using AI tools aren't impacted, continued the statement. Other companies are turning to a grab bag of strategies to address AI slop, including rallying their own patrons to help identify it. In October, Pinterest updated its system to allow users to limit how many AI-generated posts they see. TikTok said it was testing a feature in the United States that lets people dial up or down the amount of visible AI content. The company also said it had automatically labeled more than 3 billion AI-generated videos. TikTok removed more than 377,000 videos in the first 3 months of the year for violating its AI policies. AI was used to create nearly half of the posts with more than 50 words on X, Elon Musk's social media platform, according to Pangram, an AI detection startup. To deal with a tremendous amount of AI slop and reply spam, the social media platform this year banned apps that effectively encourage bots to post by paying for content, wrote Nikita Beer, who was X's head of product until this month. Chris Best, the chief executive of Substack, wrote last month that, quote, it's getting harder to tell what's real on the internet, end quote, and that, quote, platforms that reward fakeness will create a race to the bottom, end quote. The newsletter platform announced its own AI detection tool for users, powered by Pangram, which is designed to scan replies, comments, and posts longer than 100 words and decide whether they were likely written by hand or with AI help. Some newsletter writers complained that the tool mistook posts written by humans as AI-generated, did not account for AI's potential role in the creative process, and put undue pressure on authors to defend their reputations against an opaque metric. This spring, Camille Francois and nearly two dozen other AI experts convened at a Slop Salon event in Menlo Park, California, where they discussed the difficulty of classifying and thus managing AI slop. Quote, the hodgepodge of tactics is a symptom that we're looking at, a systemic problem with our information environment, and not just a bad class of content called slop that we can just define and remove, end quote, Dr. Francois, who studies harmful digital technologies at Columbia University, said in an interview. Quote, AI is a creativity tool at the end of the day, and multifaceted, and platforms that handle this in a poor way will see people walk and go to other places, end quote. Tiffany Sue reports on the information ecosystem, including foreign influence, political speech, and disinformation. The next article is entitled, Should You Invest in Bonds Right Now? And it's from the Strategies section. High-quality bonds are still safer than stocks, but they have been swinging in value, so move cautiously, our columnist says. By Jeff Sommer. Jeff Sommer writes Strategies, a weekly column on markets, finance, and the economy. Startling headlines about the bond market are inescapable. Yields of U.S. Treasuries this week touched their highest levels since the financial crisis of 2007, and bonds in Canada, Japan, and Germany breached levels they hadn't reached in at least a decade. On Wednesday, the U.S. government intervened, briefly stanching the bond market rout. The Treasury Department announced it was increasing its capacity to buy longer-term bonds to $4 billion per weekly operation from $2 billion. In response, yields moved a bit lower. This followed another Treasury intervention this month that bolstered the Japanese yen and, briefly, lowered yields on longer-term Treasuries. But volatility in the bond market returned on Thursday, as investors remained on edge. The possibility of further action by the Treasury, and perhaps by the Federal Reserve, makes predicting bond yields and prices exceptionally hazardous at the moment. Bond market turmoil can be disconcerting for investors who turn to high-quality bonds, especially Treasuries, for safety. It would be easy to think, if this is safety, count me out. But bonds continue to have many virtues. High-quality individual bonds, especially Treasuries, as well as most mutual funds, have exchange-traded funds that hold them, have traditionally been far more stable than their stock counterparts. While shares can collapse in price, U.S. Treasuries in particular are all but guaranteed to maintain their value plus interest when held to maturity. Bonds are always a valuable part of a long-term investor's toolkit, but you need to be careful when using them. Undeniably, even solid bonds have lost market value this year. There's an enduring lesson in that. If you intend to park your cash for a few months or need to sell before a bond hits maturity, you get whatever the market is offering. There are probably better options like money market funds, high-yield savings accounts, and certificates of deposit. Bond funds are better for the long haul. They can be portfolio stabilizers, offsetting the volatility of stocks. The central problem for bond investors this year is that price declines are inevitable when interest rates rise. That's essential bond math. Prices move in the opposite direction of interest rates or yields. Throughout much of the world, interest rates have been soaring. That's making bond investing especially tricky right now. Rising rates. The bond market sets interest rates through a vast series of moment-by-moment decisions by thousands of traders. As I wrote earlier this month, the market is saying that global risks are rising. A partial list of those risks includes the possibility of even higher inflation, fiercer wars and tariffs, and other geopolitical dislocations, questionable use of immense sums of capital to build artificial intelligence, an uncertain direction for the Federal Reserve under its new leadership, mounting national debt, and a broad political dysfunction. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Business section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Where rates are going tomorrow is impossible to say, but the much bigger question is how high they will go in the next decade. That's a reasonable threshold if you're contemplating the purchase of a bond that won't mature for 10 or even 30 years. Even at their recent peaks, yields aren't that high, not yet, on a historical basis. The economy in the past has grown resiliently when yields were much higher than they are now. Capital Economics, an independent financial research firm in London, takes that perspective, saying on Tuesday, "The recent sell-off in global government bond markets is significant, but it does not yet amount to a crisis." Yes, higher yields have driven up costs for borrowers of all sorts, from people seeking mortgages to those carrying credit card debt and student loans, and companies with big capital needs like tech giants building AI data centers with mountains of borrowed money. But the economy is still growing, and the stock market has largely shrugged off higher yields so far, Capital Economics said, adding, "The immediate macroeconomic impact should remain limited unless the rise in yields spreads or if it leads to a broader tightening of financial conditions." A central problem. Most individual investors in the United States hold stocks and bonds through funds, not as individual securities. In calm times, it was reasonable to think of bond funds simply as steady eddies that you could count on for reliable, if modest, returns. They provided a buffer against wild swings in stocks, the prima donnas of financial markets, with their enticing rewards and all too frequent disappointments. Lately, however, it's the bond funds that have been disappointing. This year, they are down in value nearly across the board, reflecting the sea change in global interest rates. That's hurt short-term investors, but there is a bright side for those taking a long view. The key is this: if yields linger on a higher plateau, future bond returns will be richer. That's because fund managers constantly need to buy new bonds, and higher-yielding ones will generate more income for investors via higher interest payments. In that respect, prospects for bond fund investors right now are better than they were before rates increased. It's like buying the dip in a stock index after prices have fallen. You're ahead of the game, assuming the market moves in the right direction. Don't get too excited, though. If yields continue to surge higher instead of plateauing, there will be further losses. In that case, parking your money elsewhere will turn out to be a better course. This dynamic affects individual bonds too, though if you hold a treasury to maturity, you needn't worry much about shifts in market value. Bond funds, however, are required to, quote, mark to market, end quote, or post the latest market prices, so the pain of losses is right there out in the open. What to look for? Unsuspecting investors may be dismayed by aspects of bonds that look like flaws but are in fact essential features. For instance, interest rate increases tend to have a greater negative impact on longer-dated bonds, more precisely on those with greater duration, a measure of a bond's response to changing rates. This core property of bonds is why long-term treasuries, often said to be the safest of securities, have been among the hardest hit this year. For example, since the U.S. and Israeli attack on Iran drove up interest rates in late February, the iShares 20-plus year Treasury bond ETF, which holds only long-term bonds, has lost more than 8% in total return. In that same period, the Vanguard Total Bond Market Index Fund, which contains corporate bonds in addition to treasuries, lost only about 2%. The Vanguard Fund is simple. It tracks the investment-grade benchmark, the Bloomberg U.S. Aggregate Bond Index. But from the performance standpoint, the gap between the Vanguard and iShares fund mainly comes down to duration. The Vanguard Broad Bond Market Fund has a duration of about 5.7 years compared to 14.9 years for the iShares Long-Term Treasury Fund, according to FactSet. What those numbers mean is that every time rates shift, price changes are magnified in the long-term treasury fund. So before buying any fund, you may want to check its duration for a clue about how it will behave when interest rates, which you can't control, start to oscillate. The higher it is, the greater the fund's price moves when interest rates shift. Another worthwhile metric is standard deviation, a statistic that tells you how much a fund's price swings. The iShares fund has a relatively high standard deviation, and from this perspective, it looks much more like a stock fund in the wildness of its fluctuations than a core investment-grade bond fund like the Vanguard Total Bond Market Index Fund. The swings of the Vanguard Total Bond Market Index this year, using that measure, have been modest, about one-third that of overall U.S. stock of the overall U.S. stock market, as tracked by the Vanguard Morningstar Total Stock Market ETF, according to FactSet. These kinds of details point to larger considerations. They suggest that even if bonds and bond funds have been hurt by interest rate increases this year, it's possible to avoid extreme fluctuations by choosing carefully. What's more, it's worth remembering that in big downturns, high-quality bonds, provide safety guarantees that you can't get from stocks. I happen to prefer the ease and diversification of broad index funds for both stocks and bonds. But high-quality individual bonds, including municipal bonds for minimizing tax liabilities, can be worthwhile too. I'd add a major caveat. Try to make sure that you won't need to sell such bonds prematurely. One solution for some retirees is a bond ladder containing a series of individual treasuries that mature regularly, say on an annual basis over periods like 20 years. That approach can provide steady, secure income. Inflation-protected treasuries, or TIPS, can be useful in bond ladders too. But you will need to accept that as long as interest rates shift, the market values of all these bonds will swing too. And alas, no one knows where the markets are going, either for stocks or bonds. That's why it's wise to spread your risks. Hold stocks in the hope of big returns, bonds in the case stocks don't pan out, and cash to get through the wild swings in the bond market of the kind that we're having this year. Jeff Summer writes Strategies, a weekly column on markets, finance, and the economy. The next article is from the real estate section, the Ask Real Estate column. And the first question is, my neighbor installed a camera pointing to my yard. Is that legal? The answer may partly depend on whether the device was installed with the intent to harass or intimidate. This column is by Jill Terreri Ramos. Question. In January, my spouse was walking our dog on our wooded property in Carroll County, Maryland, when our neighbor's dog came onto our property, killed our dog, and injured my husband. We do not engage with these neighbors, though one of them seems to want a reaction from us and encourages the dog to bark at us when we are in view. Now our landscaper came upon a camouflaged camera pointed directly into our totally secluded and private backyard, which we believe was put there to intimidate us or spy on us. Is this legal? What can we do? Answer. Where the camera is placed, what it can capture, who placed it there, and why it was installed matter. Quote, a security camera on a neighbor's property that incidentally captures part of a neighboring yard is different from a deliberately concealed camera positioned to monitor a secluded backyard, end quote, said Marcus Rauschecker, executive director of the Center for Cyber Health and Hazard Strategies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore. Maryland prohibits the use of cameras to conduct surveillance of others' homes, including their yards. The offender must receive a, quote, reasonable warning, end quote, or a request to stop and continue with the surveillance for the behavior to be considered a violation of the law. The infraction is a misdemeanor and can result in fines or time in prison. If the camera was placed to harass, annoy, alarm, or intimidate, you could pursue legal action to have it removed, but proving ill intent could be difficult. The law may be interpreted and applied differently across the state, depending on the jurisdiction, said David Hisley, a lawyer with Lewicki, O'Connor, Hunt, and Miser, LLC, in Fulton, Maryland. All judges' tolerance for things is different, Mr. Hisley said. To establish that the camera is part of a campaign of harassment, keep a log of negative encounters with your neighbor. You could speak with a lawyer about your case and receive guidance on pursuing criminal charges or filing for a peace order, a civil action that could ensure the neighbor stays away from you. Such orders need to be requested within 30 days from the instigating episode, and they generally last for 6 months. For both criminal and civil cases, your neighbors will be notified so they can present a defense. If you lose, you won't benefit from a legal remedy, and the relationship is likely to get worse. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times business section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The next article is also from the real estate section, the South Florida issue, and the title of the article is Can Key West Still Be a Home for Writers? By Dory Shevlin, and the subtitle is Ernest Hemingway, Judy Blume, and Other Literary Luminaries Have Long Called the Island Home. As housing costs increase, many locals are taking steps to preserve and perpetuate this legacy. In 1935, the poet Wallace Stevens wrote to his friend Harriet Monroe, the editor of Poetry Magazine, exasperated. Key West, unfortunately, is becoming rather literary and artistic. Ernest Hemingway had moved into a sprawling home on Whitehead Street a few years earlier, and now Robert Frost and the novelist John Dos Passos had also descended. Over the next few years, Tennessee Williams and the poet and short story writer Elizabeth Bishop would buy properties on the Florida island, cementing for Stevens that Key West was, quote, furiously literary, end quote. He left in 1940, never to return. Where Stevens had wished the, quote, literary and artistic, end quote, would bug off, today's Key West residents are hoping for the opposite. And this article includes, at the very top, a photo of a large white house with four rectangular columns and a white picket fence. And the caption is, in 1938, the writer Elizabeth Bishop paid the equivalent of $47,000 for this house. The Key West Literary Seminar bought it for $1.2 million in 2019. City officials, along with writers, including Judy Blume and Meg Cabot, are leading efforts to draw writers to the island and are pouring money into preserving the legacy of its writerly past. Some people lovingly refer to Key West as a drinking town with a writing problem. But for years now, the second half of that slogan has struggled. Within a few months in 2011, three bookstores on the island shut down. In 2024, the literary community faced another setback when Governor Ron DeSantis eliminated all $32 million of arts funding for Florida, forcing arts organizations to lean more heavily on private donations. And there's the feeling among many that, unlike in Stevens's time, Key West is no longer a place where writers can afford to buy property. Adjusted for inflation, Bishop's house cost her roughly $47,000 in 1938. By contrast, the median price for a single-family house on the island today is $1.8 million. There's another photo of a lush garden with palm trees and a beautiful walkway, concrete walkway with a house with shutters in the background. And the caption is, the Key West Literary Seminar spent over $2 million renovating Bishop's house using archival photos and letters to guide its historical accuracy. Ms. Cabot bought her house over 20 years ago after publishing the first 5 installments of her Princess Diaries series. It was pretty ridiculous then, she said. Now, it's ridiculous. Unlike in the past, unfortunately, you have to be a successful writer to buy, said Linda Kaufelt, a local real estate agent and the author of Key West Writers and Their Houses. You can't be a struggling writer like we were when we first came, she said. Driving up housing costs is the city's statistically high percentage of non-permanent residents. Tourism is the largest share of the island's industry, with over 30% of Key West residents working in hospitality, and roughly 15% of housing units are categorized as seasonal homes or vacation rentals, according to Census Bureau data. That percentage is higher now than in the past, though it's not a new phenomenon. Most of the 20th century writers mentioned above, Frost, Dos Passos, Stevens, were seasonal residents, as were Truman Capote, Shel Silverstein, and Ralph Ellison. Another photo includes a two-story home with a second-floor balcony over a first-floor balcony and shutters on all 8 windows on both 4 on each floor, and the caption reads, "The studios at Key West renovated this 1880s era inn to accommodate 4 artists at a time as part of its Peyton Evans artist residency." Confronted with steadily rising real estate costs, local nonprofits are working to keep parts of the island carved out for artists. In 2018, the nonprofit studios at Key West bought and renovated an 1880s era inn to be used for in its ongoing residency program, the Peyton Evans Artist Residency, now called the Pear House. The space can accommodate 4 artists and writers at a time. Florida's not necessarily known for planning, said Jed Dodds, the executive director of the nonprofit. So we want to make sure that Key West doesn't wake up one morning and have paved over that part of its soul. Each resident spends just 1 month in the Pear House, but many of them return, sometimes on book tour, sometimes to stage a play. Not that it's easy anywhere to make a living as an artist, but it's particularly hard here, said Mr. Dodds. It's our job to support them however we can. The studios at Key West is now helping to fill the void left by the 2011 bookstore closures. In 2016, Judy Bloom and her husband, George Cooper, founded Books and Books at the Studios of Key West. Because the store is run as a nonprofit, it is able to avoid steep commercial rent. In this article, there's a photo, and the caption is, "Cardboard Judy is available for selfies on days when Judy Bloom herself isn't working in the shop." And there's a cardboard cutout of Judy Bloom holding one of her books, and she's smiling. Since opening, Books and Books has become a tourist attraction in its own right, with Ms. Bloom, who often works in the store, as its unofficial mascot. That comes with some pressure. "I don't want to disappoint people," Ms. Bloom said, referring to those who might visit while she's not there. As a consolation, a cardboard cutout of Ms. Bloom, one 2D arm raised to restack a shelf, gets moved around the store, sometimes with a sign promoting banned books. In her absence, visitors, quote, "can take a picture with Cardboard Judy," end quote, Ms. Bloom said. "She's always smiling," she said. As nonprofits work to ensure Key West's literary future, they are also preserving its past. The wood frame eyebrow house Bishop bought in 1938, with a low roof that hangs over the second floor windows, was purchased in 2019 by the Key West Literary Seminar, another nonprofit, for $1.2 million. To the delight of many in the literary community, it finally reopened a year ago after painstaking renovations that used Bishop's own letters to guide its historical accuracy. Under the leadership of Arlo Haskell, the nonprofit's executive director, the house hosts high school students each summer for a writing program. For Mr. Haskell, it was paramount that the house be not just a shrine to the past, but also an incubator for future talent. The programming is designed to, quote, make sure that the literary tradition in Key West is something that's active and vital and ongoing today, end quote, he said. Quote, so it's not just something that's part of the history books, end quote. Though some worry about the writing community's survival on the island, Key West's writerly reputation at least perseveres. According to Ms. Kaufelt, who worked as Ms. Bloom's real estate agent when she sold her house, quote, the buyers insisted, they wrote into the contract, they wanted copies of all Judy Bloom's books signed, end quote. And there's a photograph of a woman walking past a cat, and the caption is, many of the polydactyl cats that live on the property of the Hemingway House trace their lineage to Ernest Hemingway's cat, Snow White, who had six toes. In addition to the fishing expeditions and bachelorette parties many flock to the island for, the Hemingway Home and Museum is another popular Key West attraction. Privately owned, it is sustained entirely by ticket revenue, gift shop sales, and wedding venue rentals, according to a museum representative. The property's famed polydactyl cats are of such interest to visitors that the museum is developing an app to showcase them. To further celebrate the writer's legacy on the island, visitors can also attend the annual Hemingway Days Festival, which includes a look-alike contest at one of the writer's old haunts, Sloppy Joe's Bar. Other literary tourism activities include a walking tour through Old Town, hosted by the Literary Seminar that ends at the hypnotically blue seaport, formerly known as Key West Bight, which inspired The Bight, a poem by Bishop. And for information, Bight is spelled B-I-G-H-T. Ultimately, Key West's beauty, the charming architecture, the blue waters, the flitting song of white-crowned pigeons, is both its appeal and its threat to writers. While writing earlier books in her windowed office, Ms. Bloom said, sometimes I had to face the wall because it's so beautiful outside. Those qualities are also what make it so attractive to docking cruise ships, daiquiri-seeking partygoers, and millionaires sniffing out second homes. But the city has always faced some version of these challenges, Mr. Dodd said, and he hopes his nonprofit can accomplish what Key West has so far managed as people enter its shores, that, quote, the island changes them more than they change it, end quote. On a recent summer afternoon, a group of high school students sat in the garden behind Bishop's house discussing sensory descriptions. For one exercise, they ate fruit grown on the property, trying to put taste into words. When Bishop lived there, these thick-leaved mango trees and coconut palms weren't even saplings. Some sprouted up naturally over the years. Landscapers planted others. On this day, the trees drooped, heavy with fruit, their wide limbs shading the riders below. Reporting this, Dory Shevlin covers real estate and the housing industry for The Times and writes about home design and decor for Wirecutter. And a portion of her comment in the comments section beneath the story includes the following from the writer, Dory Shevlin. Reporting this story was a reminder of how narrow our view of a place can be. To me, Key West was simply the island home of one of my favorite writers. Others I interviewed had no idea Hemingway ever lived there. Even icons like Elizabeth Bishop came for entirely non-literary reasons. For more on this article or the comments section, please feel free to call the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service at 716-821-5555. That's 716-821-5555. The next article is also from the New York Times real estate section, the South Florida issue. A 9,000 horse town is the title of the article, and the subtitle, Wellington, Florida, has long been a town for equestrians, and with a spate of new development, it's leaning in even more. By Tara Loder Wilkinson. Like many elite equestrians, the German Olympic gold medalist show jumper Christian Kukuk is nomadic. He lives, quote, 50-50, end quote, he said, all over Europe, with a home base of Munster, Germany, from June through December, and for the other part of the year, in the Palm Beach County village of Wellington, Florida. To each location, he brings an entourage of around 10 horses, including his champion, Checker, and a handful of grooms and trainers. To date, Mr. Kukuk, 36, has enjoyed the travel, but the birth of his daughter just over a year ago shifted his perspective. It's not so easy to travel with a one-year-old every weekend, Mr. Kukuk said. It can be disruptive and exhausting. We are going to have to figure it out. Life for Mr. Kukuk might soon get more settled. Wellington, home to the 50-year-old Winter Equestrian Festival, where stars of the sport compete for $16 million in prize money, is hoping to become a year-round destination for equestrians. Over the next 18 months, a $750 million-plus investment will bring infrastructure upgrades such as road improvements, luxury apartments, and an 86,100-square-foot covered arena, all of it with an eye toward shoring up Wellington's position as a hub of elite equestrian activity. From December to March, some 25,000 people connected to the equestrian industry and as many as 9,000 horses migrate to Wellington for dressage and hunter jumper competitions, substantially swelling its population of 62,000 for the 13-week season. Many of these equestrians have purchased homes in the area. Long-term residents include Bruce Springsteen's daughter, Jessica, and Michael Bloomberg's daughter, Georgina. The sport does big business. In 2023, the equestrian industry contributed $177 billion to the U.S. economy, around nine times more annual revenue than the NFL, according to data from the American Horse Council. And real estate is essential for equestrian competitors. Horses and their teams, which include vets, farriers, and grooms, need stables and space for competitions. Some also travel with saddle fitters, equine physiotherapists, and dentists. Competitors are willing to move if that's what it takes. Equestrian families are driving more high-end sales here, said David Wells of Equestrian Sotheby's International Realty, who himself bought in Wellington 15 years ago to support his daughter's show jumping career. He currently has a listing for a 6-acre farm in Grand Prix Village with 22 stalls, a 2-bedroom staff quarters, a lounge, and a 1-bedroom owner's quarters for $15.9 million. It backs onto the Wellington International Showgrounds, so that's our beachfront, he said. But Wellington has struggled to comfortably accommodate increasing crowds, said Michael Stone, 60, the president of Wellington International, an equestrian venue. Quote, our facilities were old and got crowded. It gave our main competitor, Ocala, an opportunity to come and eat some of our lunch, end quote, he said, referring to the Florida town a 4-hour drive away. In 2021, the World Equestrian Center opened there, becoming the largest equestrian facility in the United States. The race for a competitive edge spurred Wellington's village council to approve the $750 million development from Wellington Lifestyle Partners that will include homes priced from $5 million, expanded showgrounds, and a commercial marketplace with a boutique hotel, shops, restaurants, and office space, plus some $10 million of traffic improvements. The development, in partnership with Nexus Luxury Collection, the global hospitality and real estate company co-founded by Tiger Woods, Ernie Els, Joe Louis, and Justin Timberlake, aims to attract residents beyond equestrians. Quote, we hope it will help people have a full life with kids and set a routine, end quote, said Paige Bellissimo Nunez, 34, president and partner of Wellington Lifestyle Partners and a former amateur show jumper. The investments will hopefully help establish a year-round economy for the community, said Jim Barnes, Wellington Village manager. Quote, that evolution can help reinforce Wellington's status as the global capital of equestrian sport, end quote. As part of the deal, the residential and commercial construction can begin only once the new equestrian facility is up and running. Set to open this November, the updated horse show will expand to 188 acres from 97 after a parcel of undeveloped woodland was rezoned in 2024. Show entrances will double to 4. Stables will increase both in size and number to 300 from 180. And the parking lot capacity will expand to 3,000 vehicles from 700. Competitions will take place in one larger facility rather than two separate ones, which competitors use to ride or drive between. The new covered arena will also help horses, which are vulnerable to extreme temperatures during the summer when highs in the low 90s are typical. The ideal temperature for sport horses is between 55 and 88 degrees. The new development has not been without controversy, even from within the equestrian community. Some oppose that nearly 100 acres for the homes are being reallocated from the village's equestrian preserve, a 9,000-acre area zoned to prioritize a rural atmosphere and equine facilities over dense commercial development. Quote, we are gaining exactly nothing, end quote, said Lauren Brody, 60, a resident real estate agent and equestrian who owns 4 show jumping horses. Quote, some people will gain tremendously, but it won't be better for the horse community. My question is, who are we building for? A handful of obnoxious billionaires who said the homes weren't nice enough? End quote. Mr. Barnes, the village manager, said, the approvals were evaluated through the lens of comprehensive planning, economic sustainability, preservation of community character, and long-term public benefit. Adding that the project includes investments in amenities, quote, that are intended to enhance the overall quality of life for residents while supporting one of the region's most important economic engines. Quote, what's happening to Wellington is making me sad, honestly, end quote, said Randy Halversrod, 71, a former competitive equestrian. Ms. Halversrod ran a dressage farm for 30 years in the village of Little Ranches, a 15 to 20 minute drive from the horse show. Tired of fighting development, she is selling her home, Halversrod Farm, and moving to North Florida to live near her son. The problem is that when one developer is allowed to take land from the equestrian preserve, it sets a precedent for others to do so. Those who oppose the development in Wellington have had some victories. Earlier this year, plans to build a new country club and luxury homes on the historic Isla Carroll Polo Field by developer Frank McCourt in conjunction with Discovery Land Company were rejected on the grounds that they were not centered on equestrian use. But for some, new development is needed to make Wellington not just a home for their sport, but a place to put down roots. 4 years ago, Mr. Kukuk's wife bought a house in Wellington where the family lives when in town for competitions. Mr. Kukuk rents a farm and stables for these periods, but he foresees that when his daughter reaches school age, he will buy a farm and stables and settle more permanently. The nice thing about Wellington is we can be a family the whole season, he said. And there are other reasons equestrians might seek out real estate, such as hedging against the vagaries of horses. Horses can be high risk, whereas real estate is more of a safe bet, said Andrew Bournes, 42, an Irish international Grand Prix rider and entrepreneur who moved to Florida 17 years ago. He currently owns 10 elite show jumping horses in Wellington and trains and coaches around 20 more. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 23rd issue of the New York Times Business Section. We read from the New York Times Business Section every Thursday at 11 a.m. Your reader has been Jonathan Roger. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the USA Today. Following that at 2 o'clock is episode number 7 of A World Appears by Michael Pollan. Stay with us for these readings and more.